Good morning, everybody. Thank you for joining Vermont Community Foundation's Investment Strategy and Performance Update. My name is Debbie Dabrowski, and I'm the CFO at the Vermont Community Foundation. I'm here with Mike Miller with Colonial Consulting. I'm just going to do a little bit of housekeeping. We are going to be muting the lines periodically during the call, but we'll unmute them to make sure you have time to ask questions. And, of course, at the end of the presentation that Mike has, the slide deck, we will also open it up for questions. Everyone should have received from Tim Hagus the slide deck with the call information. Obviously, if you're on the call, you've got that information. And at this point, I will turn it over to Mike to start the slide deck with you. So we're going to put it on mute. Okay, let's mute it. Okay, great. Well, jump right in, Mike.
So good morning, all. Nice to be with you on this very balmy day in Vermont. So you have the slide deck in front of you, and I'm going to walk you through the slide. I do want to start with a message, though, which is that we're sitting in a time where we've actually had a very good year in terms of the gains in the portfolio. They have fallen short of the benchmark, although that is changing as we speak. And it's an unusual time because it's usually rising markets make us nervous. And this one is a little different in that it's created some incredible opportunities for us, which is part of the reason we've underperformed so far this year. It's also part of the reason that we're incredibly excited to move forward about the opportunity to get back to the levels of outperformance that we've had historically in the portfolio. And so I will ask you to turn to slide two, where we'll begin with the three pools. As you remember, there are three major pools we track and for the purpose of our call. Long-term pool. We have three different benchmarks for that pool. The custom market benchmark, as a reminder, takes the strategic asset mix of the pool, stocks, bonds, and otherwise, and creates a benchmark that reflects index fund performance for the exact same allocation that we have. The 70-30 is a mix of global stocks and U.S. bonds, and the purpose of that is to see whether or not a simple index portfolio just would have been better than what we're doing. And then CPI plus 5, which is the ultimate long-term measure of what an endowment's health is, you need to outperform that over time, or at least match it to perpetuate philanthropic capital. We'll talk a little bit later about how the perpetuation of philanthropic capital is a combination of generating strong returns, but also generating those returns without too much volatility, so we'll come back to that. The socially responsible pool is the next set of lines, and you can see that it is also compared to a custom market benchmark. It's a different benchmark because it has a different asset mix, but needs to say the exact same interpretation as you would use for the long-term pool compared to its custom benchmark. And last but not least, the midterm pool, which we'll look at in a minute, is a more conservatively managed pool. It's a less volatile pool. It's intended for capital here at the foundation that would be distributed at a much quicker pace, and therefore can't be subjected to the same amount of volatility as the other two pools. So it should underperform over long periods of time. It will outperform in bad markets because it's more conservative, but that's how that one is structured. And in a few minutes, I'll show you the differences in the mixes in a moment. So just a couple of quick observations. The first being that you can see the SR pool, socially responsible pool, has been outperforming the long-term pool really all the way out now into 7 years. And that's a function of the fact that it's actually a more aggressive pool. It's got more stocks in it than the long-term pool. It's a well-diversified pool, but not as diversified as the long-term pool. And so during very, very good markets, it's mostly a fossil pool, so it will outperform. During more difficult markets, the long-term pools are likely to outperform. And over 10 years, you can see long-term pools eked out a modest level of outperformance compared to the socially responsive pool. The second point I would make is that both pools, calendar year-to-date through October, are underperforming their benchmarks. As I mentioned earlier, I'm going to come back to some length later, so I won't belabor the point now. We're in a very interesting market, and I'll talk about that a little bit more later. And you know, sometimes we underperform it because you're making mistakes. And sometimes we underperform it because other people are making mistakes. And we actually really, really strongly believe it's the latter, and I will show you why in a minute. The good thing is that when you perennially underperform, then it can't just be someone else's problem. But that was not been the case here. For 3 years, 5 years, 7 years, 10 years, and since April 1st, 2002, the long-term pool has outperformed its benchmark by, you know, very healthy margins, which is why I'm glad to say that the underperformance this year is an unusual occurrence, but it was never, it's never had it happen before, by the way. It's not the first time, and it won't be the last. The socially responsive pool is the same story, underperforming this year. The outperformance is more focused on 5 and 7 years, as you can see, but needless to say, it's also been a very successful pool. And both pools fortuitously for us, don't demand that we answer the question, why not put the whole thing in index funds? Because if we had done that, we'd have much less return looking backward, and we actually think much, much less return looking forward. So if you turn to the next slide, slide 3, here you can see the performance compared to other endowments and foundations for the long-term pool. Now we've switched the date on you here. This is not October, this is September. And the reason we switched the dates is not because we want to show you different dates. It's because the database we use, the Investor Force database, only comes out quarterly. And so what you're looking at in the middle set of bars is the performance of the pool compared to the median return of this universe. The universe has about 1,100 now endowments and foundations in it. And you can see year-to-date, it's the same story as you saw a minute ago. The portfolio is outperforming to varying degrees the median endowment and foundation by significant margins over most periods, but not so far this year. And so that's been the same issue that we mentioned on the prior page. The beige bar at the top shows you the quartile ranking of the foundation. So fourth is the worst, but it means the bottom 25% of all endowments and foundations for the last 9 months. We got the 30 years, you're at the second quartile, which is above the median, but not the top quartile. And then the 7 years is the same area, above the median, but not the top quartile. 5 years and 10 years, though, top 25%. And as we point out, the 15-year number is actually top 4%. So outperforming 96% of other endowments and foundations over 15 years. And we actually think that we're very much set up to repeat something in that neighborhood, and maybe not top four, but in that type of vicinity, let's call it. And so this performance has been a kind of very consistent with the prior page. And as the fourth quarter unfolds, I can tell you two things we can see right now. It's not the end of December, so I'm not going to stick my neck out too far on this, but November was one of the best months the portfolio's had in a long, long time that I can remember, both absolute and return. December shaping up in a similar way. And if that were to hold, the fourth quarter is going to be one of the biggest, six most successful quarters in a long time, wiping out all the underperformance and bringing the portfolio back to a top quartile ranking against other endowments and foundations. That's what's kind of been baked into the cake as far as we're concerned. We're happy to see it happen now and not later. But nevertheless, we're feeling incredibly good, not just at our opportunity set, but by the fact that markets are starting to recognize what we think is the obvious. So if you turn to slide 4, let's just cover some of the things that have led to the long-term success and also the things that keep us going when returns aren't as good in the short term. We have to have the ability to stick to our knitting when things don't look so good. It's not as easy to do so, of course. So there are three basic principles that we use here. The first is that we maintain a mix of stocks, bonds, and some alternative investments that are driven by each pool's objectives. I'll show you that in a minute. The second point is we deploy fee dollars efficiently. We're not trying to minimize fees or eliminate fees. We like to lower fees, don't get me wrong, but we think that fee dollars need to be spent in a manner that generates an outcome that's worth having for the foundation. So we're willing to pay more for things as long as the outcomes are worth it, and that's the best way to think about it. But we do start, by the way, with an overarching view that high fees are bad, and so I think that's a very important balancing act you have to have. And the third thing is we think about portfolio risk. In rising markets, nobody wants to think about risk. But the reality is that markets are cyclical. Bad things happen, good things happen. Over time, they rise. But needless to say, a lot of things happen along the way on the path to rising. And so you need to think about risk. And that's been a major factor behind the foundation's long-term success.
So I'm just going to pause for a second and see if there's any questions. If you're dialed in through the computer, there should be an unmute button on your computer. If you're on the phone, you can press *6 and ask a question. So take a moment to see if there's any questions on the slides that Mike has already covered. Okay, we will keep on going.
Okay. Thank you all. So if you turn to slide 5 now, I promised earlier that we would look at the differences in the mixes of the three pools. So the long-term pool, as you can see, is 52.5% in public equities, is 21.5% in various types of fixed income, and 21% in alternative investments, which consists of hedge funds and private assets. The socially responsible pool is 60% in equities, 30% in bonds, and 5% in private assets. And the midterm pool is 47.5% and 47.5%. And all three pools have a 5% allocation to Vermont investors, which is very important. Part of the strategy and part of the foundation's work. Now, the differences that I want to observe to you very briefly here. First of all three pools are very well diversified geographically and by asset type. You'll also note that the darling asset class, of course, the last 10 years has been the S&P 500 and U.S. stocks. We have plenty of U.S. stocks. We also have plenty of stocks outside the United States. That's about a long-term view of risk, a long-term view of return opportunities. Popularity and future investment returns are negatively correlated, I'm afraid to say. So we're very cognizant of that fact. And we try to lean away from things that are popular to things that are less popular as long as they're most selective. The second point, very quickly, special opportunities is an unusual bucket. What we put in that bucket in the long-term pool are investments that have a lot of concentration, a lot of specificity. They're high-octane equity strategies, essentially. And they've been one of the major contributors to long-term returns in this portfolio. The other differences, I earlier mentioned the fact that the SR pool is outperforming the long-term pool over periods out to 7 years. So you can see one of the major contributors to that, one has been that the SR pool is extremely well managed. That's good. We love that. The other is that it's got more stocks. And in a rising market, that's very good for its future. The mid-term pool, you can see last other point, I mentioned that it's much more defensive. And that's the 47.5% you can see in fixed income, as vastly more than the other two pools. But needless to say, it's why it's there, because that is going to be less volatile. It's going to have less returns. Slide 6 is a quick look, and I'm not going to spend too much time on this manager due diligence. I want to get to some of the other topics, but I do want to point out that the foundation pursues a very, very interesting, I would argue, a unique approach to manager selection, which is that we are very happy to own index funds or index proxies, and thus we can find managers that generate a lot of outperformance. And so some of the basic rules are here, and a lot of this falls under Colonial fate to make sure this is all being covered the right way, but the foundation ultimately decides. Return is always accompanied by risk is rule one. Rule two, and this is the Colonial part, we need to understand the strategy, know the key people, and avoid needless complexity. So that's why we don't invest, for example, in black boxes or quantitative strategies or places with a lot of leverage. And the reason we don't do those things is because it's impossible to know what's going on. And we think as fiduciaries, you must know what's going on. And we like to look people in the eye. So we travel extensively to go see everybody, and that's incredibly significant. When we come back here to advise Dan and advise the investment committee about what to do with the portfolios, that we can have firsthand experience and knowledge that hopefully will be useful. Operational issues, to be clear, is a place where we don't take risk. There's a very robust operational framework both here at the foundation and at our firm to make sure that there's no problems going on in the portfolio. We start off with the assumption that things must be a certain way, and if they're not, we go someplace else. And last but not least, this is an ongoing, forward-looking process. That's the other, I think, critical element that separates some of the greater investors of all time from those who aren't, which is that if you just react to the past and kind of follow along what's going on, you tend to lose. If you instead look forward and assume that things will be cyclical, you have a lot of advantages. One more slide, and we'll pause for questions again before we switch gears. Slide 8 takes a look at the beginnings of the conversation around risk in the portfolio. So we've shown this to you before, those of you on this call. Hedge funds are by far the most controversial part of this portfolio, and they are for good reason. The hedge fund industry as a group has been a complete and utter failure. If your goal in life is to enrich hedge fund managers, it's been massively successful, I suppose, but if your goal in life is to generate a return on the capital, on your capital that's worthwhile, the answer is it's been terrible. So why do we own hedge funds is always a very good question. So this chart goes all the way back to the beginning of the foundation's hedge fund portfolio, which is February 1st, 2003 was the very first hedge fund added to this portfolio. The way you read this chart is it's returns compared to volatility. So returns, the vertical scale higher, of course, is better. And volatility or standard deviation is the horizontal scale. As you move out to the right, what you're seeing there is you're getting more and more bouncing around. And in a few minutes, I'll talk about why that is not just uncomfortable, but also can be destructive to philanthropy and to the work of the foundation and all of you in a moment. So the diamond you see on this page, that is the return of the 70-30 benchmark I showed you earlier. And you can see it's returned about 7.5% per year and has had volatility of about 10.5% or so. The blue circle is the long-term pool, which you can see has actually had more return, over 8% per year, and less volatility. That's a very important balance. And part of the complexity that we showed you earlier about the asset mix, part of the complexity of owning hedge funds and a variety of other things we do, are done for this exact purpose, which is we want to increase our returns, and we also want to do so without increasing our volatility. And so this is a really great outcome, which we want to kind of try to repeat. So the way you think about how you manage a portfolio's volatility is you have several tools at your disposal. The two most common ones are basically to own stocks and the other to own bonds. So we're not showing you the stock market on this graph, but the stock market's volatility historically is about 15%, just to give a sense of where it would appear on this page. The yellow circles are showing here is the bond market, and it has volatility of about 3%. And you can see here it has a return of about 4% per year. Those are your two primary tools. Now, starting about 10 years ago or so, a lot of people became, 15 years ago, people became interested in hedge funds as a third tool to control this, to add to this equation, this diversification of stocks and bonds. And the theory was, hey, this stuff isn't going to be as volatile as the stock market. It'll be kind of like the bond market. It'll generate great returns, which will make a big difference and are better than bonds, so to speak. The orange circle completely debunks that myth, which is the performance of the hedge fund industry. We use something called the fund of funds composite, which we think is not a perfect, but it's a good representation of the industry. And you can see it's not worked well at all. The average fund of funds has returned less than the bond market and had more volatility. And so therefore, the whole theory that this was going to be a productive contributor to the overall results of a portfolio is just wrong. Now, still have to answer the question, why do we own these things? And the answer is the maroon circle. This is the performance of the Vermont Community Foundation hedge fund portfolio. Again, and everything is net of fees, just to be clear. Every single number, including even that HFRI number, is net of fees. So I don't want anyone to get the deduct fees from this. You don't. The maroon circle, though, is the Community Foundation's investment long-term pools hedge fund portfolio. And just to be clear what it is, it's every single hedge fund that's been used historically. Every good one, every not-so-good one, put all together, this is the outcome. So our mistakes are very much in this number. And that maroon circle, you can see, has actually generated something kind of interesting for us. First of all, it's returned about 6.25% per year. I will tell you, I've said this on prior calls, when it gets to 7, we'll be slamming the table. This was absolutely great idea. 6.25 isn't quite as satisfying as 7 will be. And when we get to 7, we'll lucky. But needless to say, 6.25 is not a bad return, and it's well above both the bond market and other hedge funds. And that has been an important point here. This has pulled that blue circle to the left, vis-a-vis owning more stocks, has created a greater balance in the portfolio. So we're actually feeling very much like this. We know for a fact that the hedge fund portfolio has actually very much contributed to the outcomes of the portfolio as a whole over time. And then when that day is no longer, when that's no longer the case, we will not own hedge funds. We are not married to this area. They have to make a productive contribution. Let me stop there and see if there are questions so far.
And just remind everybody to ask a question by phone, just press star 6. Or to ask a question if you're dialed into your computer, just press the unmute button.
Okay. So I've been alluding to volatility and risk and returns, and these concepts get, one of the reasons people spend so much time looking at returns is they're very, very straightforward. Your returns are X, and they could have been Y, and it's not hard to interpret that. Once you start interesting volatility, risk, and all these other pieces of the equation, they're really important, but they're very, very hard to articulate and illustrate what they really, really mean, especially because everybody has different views of what risk even is. So let's go to something we can all agree on, which is that the dollars that are created by your funds here are the only thing that really matters. Everything else is really secondary. And by dollars, we define this very simply. You put money in this foundation, it's invested, it generates a return on the capital, and you spend from that, and you distribute to the philanthropy and causes you care about in the state and elsewhere. So if you think about that, the growth of the dollars plus what you spent is the, what's called charitable throughput of this investment strategy that we're using. So we want to illustrate how this works. And what we did is we went back to March 31st, 2002, and the reason we picked that day is that's when Colonial came onto the scene, so that's just our start date here with the foundation. What we did is let's pretend that $1 million fund showed up on that date, and along the way, 5% of a 20-quarter average was distributed each year, year in, year out, and nothing was ever added to the pool, to the fund. So 1 million, 5% a year, no additions. And let's figure out what happened if we would have invested in one of three ways. The blue bars are an investment in the long-term pool. The orange bars are invested in 60% S&P 500, 40% Bloomberg aggregate, which is the old Barclays aggregate, and the S&P itself, which is where the gray bars. Now, I will tell you that I know people disagree with me on this, but I will say that to us, the idea that you put 100 of your money in the S&P 500 is absolutely insane. It makes no sense. That's 50 U.S. stocks. That is the ultimate idea of non-diversification, if you ask us. But needless to say, we're using that here because it's been the clear winner over the last 10 years, and therefore it's a very popular strategy, and we want to kind of head-on hit the problem with it, even when it wins. It doesn't win, is our point. So the first set of bars is the change in the value. So remember, we started with $1 million, we took out 5% per year, overall this period of time. And this is what's left is the growth after that. Again, no addition. So the fund balance of the Vermont Community Foundation pool of investment is about $450,000 plus the note. So $1.45 million is what would be in the fund at that point. If the portfolio instead had been invested in a pool, the fund should have been invested in 60-40 to index funds. It would have had less, as you can see, as an ending fund balance. But had it been invested in the S&P 500, it would have had more, actually about $150,000 more ending fund balance. So that's interesting. And that gets to the point of those who say, see, you should have just put the whole thing in the S&P 500, and everybody would have been better off. Except till you get to the next set of bars, which is let's take a look at what came out of these portfolios, these three donor funds over time. And there's a blue bar, which is the Community Foundation pool, significantly outpacing the other two, especially the S&P 500, which it outpaces by almost $200,000. And this is because, I'll show you in a minute how ugly this is for the S&P, but this is because volatility lowers spending at exactly the worst possible times. And I think about that when the markets are plunging, the idea of cutting back on philanthropy is a really, really, really bad idea. But that's what a volatile all-equity index does. And it's no surprise to most of us that when the stock market's doing badly, the economy's not probably doing well, and there's probably a lot more need for this capital. And so it's a really, really bad relationship. So that's what you see in the middle set of bars, is how much more successful the investment in the pool has been in terms of actually distributing capital. The third, which is this philanthropic throughput or charitable throughput, just adds the first two bars. So it doesn't have any significance. But it does point out that the blue bar is the highest, and that's not because of the highest ending fund balance, because whatever it gave up in fund balance, it more than made up in spending. And that creates a superior outcome, not by risk, but by dollars. And I think this is a very important part of the equation. So if you turn to the next slide in, just to highlight how powerful this is. Slide 11 takes the same period of time, excuse me, and shows you that the Community Foundation, those blue bars, that the portfolio itself, the long-term pool, returned almost 15% less cumulative than the S&P 500 over this period of time. However, it produced 2.1% more impact. Again, that's the spending plus the change in fund balance. And so that's a huge swing. Think about that. You have a 15% tax on your returns, and yet you still come out ahead in dollars, which is interesting. And I will tell you one more thing, which I will answer for 5 years from now, I hope, for 7 years, whatever it will be. The S&P just had one of the best runs in its history. The Community Foundation portfolio is going to outperform it going forward, if you ask me. So this whole thing is going to reverse and get even more dramatically in favor of the DCF. But even at a time where the long-term pool is underperforming, it's doing more work in this community, which is, I think, very important. The second line at the bottom, we never really spent much time on 60-40, but for those who say, well, okay, I won't put all my money in the stock market, I'll put some in the bond market, two index funds are great. And here, actually, what we didn't show you the number at the top, I probably should add it. The DCF actually did outperform the 60-40, but we did leave the most important point, which it actually also generated 17% more philanthropic capital. Again, that's the change in fund balance plus the spend. Now, just to put the last nail in the coffin, we think, of the S&P 500 strategy, go to slide 12. So this looks at those middle bars from slide 10 and just takes a look over time, what the time series looks like. And so the blue, again, is the Vermont Community Foundation investment portfolio. The orange is the 60-40, and the gray is the S&P 500. And, you know, the blue is not perfect, but, again, this concept of controlling your volatility and still earning very good returns leads to an upward-sloping line. It's not perfect. It doesn't always keep going up, but it doesn't plunge in any period of time here for the most part. It stays flat a few of the times, some of the tougher times, and we can live with that. The orange bar has a similar pattern, but because it's not as good a portfolio, the returns are so much lower, then it's not obviously as good an outcome. The S&P, which is a much better performing portfolio, but look at the pattern here. It has these gigantic swings negatively. In fact, the worst one being from 2008 to 2013, where spending literally drops year after year after year, and that's the part that kills the S&P. Remember, we use a 20-quarter average to measure what the market value is for applying the spending rate. So once the S&P has one of those shock years, the down 45% type years that it will have from time to time, it's just that lasts for years. Its impact just keeps going on and on and on, and it's just an awful, awful equation. And even with all this most recent, you can see the huge run in the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, the S&P's come roaring back. But this is a philanthropic nightmare. You know, this is. I'm sure any of you who work in nonprofits, you don't want your budget being affected by this kind of a year-to-year change. It's just awful. So long story short, this is why We spend so much time making the portfolio a little more complicated, Sometimes we pay fees to get returns that look better this way and from this perspective, and this is in a nutshell what we're trying to do. So the last thing I want to talk about, and I will pause for any questions you have so far, is what's going on in the markets today and why we are so excited, which is an unusual condition for us, I will admit.
So if anyone has questions, star 6 or unmute button on their computer.
Okay, so I apologize. I'm using you all as guinea pigs. I've never really used these slides before, so I hope this will not be a completely irrational set of comments. So this started with a bunch of people sent us articles recently. We've been watching this ourselves, of course, about the death of the investment management community, people shutting down funds and what's going on. And it's a really good question. And does this mean that we need to think differently, et cetera. And the answer is we always need to think differently, so that part's easy. But we sat back and started to think about, well, what's really going on in markets and what's changed? And it's not hard to figure that one out. What's changed is the rise of technology in investing. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, algorithmic trading, there's a whole bunch of different terminology that gets thrown around to describe this. So slide 13. We start with the idea of dinosaurs versus machines. So dinosaurs is in quotes because we'd be the ones accused of being the dinosaurs, just to be clear who the dinosaur is. We don't really think they're dinosaurs, but needless to say, maybe the dinosaurs didn't think that either. So therefore, we'll see what happens. But let's start with just a couple of quick things. The first thing on the first bullet point, quantitative funds are a huge portion of the market. There are estimates that they're responsible for up to 90% of daily trading volume. They are already something in the order of 50 to 60% of all invested capital are run in some kind of a quantitative manner today. This is a very, very big trend. And it has three different components to it. So people combine all these things and they're very, very different. The first group, high frequency trading, I'm not going to tell you what that is, but what it basically means is these are funds or investors, quote unquote, that essentially provide liquidity in the market. They flip securities really, really quickly. They do have people like foundations who invest with them, but for the most part, they're just a trading mechanism. They're constantly trading. They're not what any of us in this room think of as a investment strategy for a long-term investor, although they could be. But they're essentially the plumbing of the markets, let's call it that way. And actually, they're not part of the issue at all. So you can pretty much dismiss them, in our opinion. There's a lot of debate about what impact they've had on markets. We tend to think that they're somewhere between neutral and maybe the market's a little bit cheaper in terms of trade. So they're not a bad thing by any means, no matter what you hear. The second group, which is the biggest group, is the rise of index funds. Now, people don't think of index funds as computer trading models, and they're really not. However, but they are run by computers. It's an index. It owns a certain number of securities and a certain level of weights. And if you buy an index, you buy those securities, it's automated. There's no basic human judgment going on, at least in terms of running the index itself. There's also another little tangent to that group called factor funds. So factor funds are things like you may have heard of minimum volatility index funds or growth index funds or variety of index funds that try to isolate a particular type of investment factor, whether it be economic or otherwise. And those are quantitative strategies as well, because kind of computer figures out what the portfolio should look like and then essentially, you know, there may not be a human being involved actually telling them the trades executed, but the fact is that these are a big part of the quantitative world. You may have read recently that index funds have now actually overtaken actively managed funds in terms of the size of the amount of capital invested in index and factor funds. Last but not least are the quantitative investment funds themselves. So this is another group. So think about firms like, if you've heard of firms like AQR or Renaissance or other big managers or Bridgewater that trade, they're not index funds. They're active managers, but they use computers to trade. And some of them have developed strategies where the computers are actually developing their own strategy. So this is like the artificial intelligence ideas where computers essentially are doing things and the people who at the firms don't even really know what they're doing exactly. It's a very interesting idea. So that's the landscape of these gigantic amounts of capital that are in the quantitative world today. And if you went back 30 years ago, none of this existed. So it is a really, really significant change, and it has implications. So let's start off with who are the losers, because if you don't want to be a dinosaur, you better know who the dinosaurs are. So there really are two groups of losers in our opinion. The first group are those who in the past had an advantage because they had information. In a world where information and data
were not nearly as widely available. You know, there were advantages. There's some great old stories about somebody seeing a ship pull into a dock and getting a news flash from a pigeon before other people did. You go way back in time. And all the stuff that was real value, real wealth created by just knowing stuff that people know. We used to go, and I started this business, there were investment firms that would send out research analysts to go to, you know, watch stores and see what was happening in stores and try to get insights, talk to managers of stores and figure out what's going on in the business before everybody else does. Well, that's absurd. It's not possible anymore. All this stuff is out there. All this data is out there. And it can be purchased or it can be acquired for free. So if your whole advantage in life was that you knew stuff that other people don't know about short-term events, you're done. You have no chance in the world where these computers are going to be about a billion times faster than you're going to be, if not more. The second thing is, and that's the latest point, is timeliness. So if you knew something before other people did, again, you have no chance whatsoever. So if you know any investors who tell you that they just know stuff other people don't know, I'd be very suspicious of you. The second group that loses big are those who rely on consistency. And this is where we are struggling too. We don't like to underperform, as I mentioned earlier. We do a lot of things with diversification of our portfolio to try to keep that from happening in any material way. But this market and the way these quantitative funds influence the market essentially does create some really, really big dispersions of return and a lot of powerful momentum in markets. So that's something that we're struggling with too, and we're trying to figure out how to deal with it in a responsible way. But so consistency is definitely a problem in portfolios today, and it will probably remain a problem. As we wrote at the bottom, most traditional active management suffers, but not all. So if you turn to slide 14, let's talk about where this does work and where it doesn't work. So first of all, let's talk about some of the hidden costs of the rise of quantitative investing. So the first thing is, if you look at the first bullet point, quantitative strategy, if you sat down and talked with quantitative managers, and we do this quite a bit actually, what you'll find is there isn't something that I think is best described as an arms race. They're constantly developing new ideas, and if they find that it wins, it doesn't win for long because other people copy their ideas, because there's a lot of, it's probably 5 quantitative managers or 10, you put them all in a room. They're all PhDs and stuff that I can barely pronounce the names, and they're just brilliant people who clearly know what they're doing. And so they're all fighting the same exact battle, and they're all using the same data for the most part. Now, they might massage it in different ways and do different things with it, but at the end of the day, if something's working, they're all going to figure it out. And yes, getting there first is absolutely beneficial to you, but it's got a very short half-life in this point in time because it just disappears over time. The second point, which is really important, there is differentiation. If you talk to 5 quantitative managers, you hear 5 different approaches to what they do. But at the end of the day, they're all looking for these things that are creating anomalies in the market where they think they can have an edge. And it goes away, and the way it goes away, they all start doing the same thing. So there's an old term in Wall Street named crowded, which is when everybody races into something at one time. That's what you see with quantitative strategies, and it creates a lot more crowding than the markets have ever seen historically, at least from our perspective. So this creates some really interesting distortions. So again, if your strategy is, hey, I know stuff other people don't know, you got a big problem. If your strategy is that you want market prices to reflect fundamental value in a more narrow band, i.e. consistency, you've got a big problem. But if, on the other hand, you're willing to take the other side of crowding and extremes in prices, you have an interesting opportunity. And that's what we're playing out in the second bullet point, which is that you get this almost unbelievable level of market distortion in this pricing. And every now and then we look at positions in the portfolio and we say, how can that possibly be trading at that price? The normal analysis would be, we must be missing something. Something must be in this equation that we don't understand. And then you realize it's not. It's just that this stuff is not in the favored crowd. It's not been going up. And so the crowd just pummels these things into the ground and basically takes everything else to the moon. And it's a really interesting problem and a great opportunity, except for that last bullet point. Having the ability to ride out storms when they come along is not something most people are wired to do. So we spend a lot of time, the committee here does, Dan does, Debbie does, and with the managers we do, so making sure that they can tolerate these swings without panic, because emotion is everybody's undoing in investing. And while these massive opportunities are being created because of quantitative momentum type investing, they're also creating a lot of emotion, and it's not good emotion. So if you turn to the next slide, this was just a very simple picture, which we think helps illustrate what's going on. So this is an analysis that was done by Bernstein, and it's based on the Ken French Data Library. So as you know, quantitative investing and index investing and academics, it's prominent French are legendary. So this data set goes back to 1951, and it looks at the cheapest and the most expensive part of the U.S. stock market. And the cheapest is measured by, everything is measured by trailing price earnings ratios. Lower, of course, being cheap, higher being expensive. The top line, which is unfortunate, this is not our graph, so I apologize for the very similar colors, but the top line is the expensive stuff. The one at the bottom, the trail hole on the bottom, is the cheap stuff. And the key things to think about are this. The first thing is there's obviously a spread between the top and the bottom. Cheap stuff is going to be cheaper than expensive stuff. That's self-evident. But it's the gaps that are interesting and the way they evolve over time. Now, the red arrows are what we drew. And so the one that points to the left and down, that's the TMT bubble in 1999 and the boom of the Internet bubble, old economy, new economy. I think those are old enough to remember that time. And that was a time where, obviously, things got way ahead of themselves, and there was gross levels of misvaluation of technology, media, and telecom stocks. And because the Internet was going to take over the universe, which, by the way, it did. However, the stock prices still did reflect the actual business dynamics of a lot of these companies. Many of them did go bankrupt, or at least were terrible investments going forward. But what's important here is that was not computers. That was just a good old-fashioned bubble. People got excited. The stocks kept going up. You could buy pets.com, and it would keep going up and up and up and up and up, and you just felt really smart. That was the old-fashioned bubble. Go now to the right, where we have this arrow drawing points to the right. That's not today. Actually, that's the end of 2018. Again, not our graph, so this was not through this year. However, I will say this. What happened is, through August of this year, that spread got wider. It's now trying to come back in again, which is part of the reason that we're feeling better about the portfolio. But needless to say, it's nowhere near even back to where it started. Now, what's important about this is look how much wider that spread is compared to even the last big bubble we had in the stock market, interest stock market bubble in 1999. So that's interesting. And even more interesting is what's in that top group. So back in the late 90s, you could argue, I think the very overly simplistic assessment of what happened was people did get excited about a real change in our technology and our world, and they mispriced it, and that happens. Today, this is not really that smart, frankly. This is even dumber. What's in that top group right now is there's some companies like Amazon and Salesforce and businesses that are absolutely disruptive and they're very successful businesses, and you can make an argument that maybe they're worth these prices, maybe they're not. But what's also in this group now, REITs, utilities, consumer product businesses like Kellogg's, the staples, we call them, this stuff's in there, and this stuff's in there now for a couple reasons. One is we live in a fear bubble. We've talked about it on other calls, where people are just terrified of, for good reason, economic and geopolitical conditions, and they want to own stocks, but not too much risk, so they keep bidding up these very safe businesses, supposedly, to prices that, literally, there's not a single way, you know, like I said, if you pick Amazon 1999, nobody can debate your brilliance. No one is ever going to be accused of being brilliant for paying 60 times for a REIT or Kellogg's. These are just dumb decisions that are being made. But again, this is the computers. This is the momentum. This is what's working, and this is what's popular, and it's created this massive disparity in prices. And what I'm trying to also say to you is that that point of going from this last kind of hyperbolic swing up at the very right-hand side of the page, that's the part where everybody gives up. That's the point where if you didn't own those things, you either lose your job because you're not a good investor anymore. People get very disappointed in outperformance and they fire you, underperformance and they fire you. Just people throw in the towel. And that's just human nature too. So my point is that this is all related to, it's not just about computers. You need something that lights the fire underneath them, of course. And in this case, it was the fear bubble, negative interest rates, all the things we've been living with for 10 years in this country have been, and around the world, have been part of this equation. However, here's the last point. This gap is a huge opportunity. And the foundation can profit from it two ways. One is we own stuff near the bottom, and we're stunned by how the stuff at the bottom, these are not binary businesses that will only do well if the world's economies get better. These are just businesses that will do well because they're doing well already, but they're not popular. They might be in Europe. They might be a bank. They might be something where people just don't like the area and it's just not, it's considered too risky. Even though it's not risky at all. And so it's just fascinating. And the second way the foundation profits, that hedge fund portfolio. There's a lot of short selling, which means you try to profit from falling prices of the stuff at the top. And that will give us a double whammy on the positive side coming down on this revolver. So last thing, and I'll stop for questions. Slide 16. So we're excited because of the computers. The computers have created this, like I said, almost unbelievable opportunity. I can't wait for, I don't know if it'll be next year, 2 years, 3 years from now, to look back and say, wow, how easy was that? But we'll see. We'll wait for that to happen first.
But balance and patience are essential. So even when we feel very strong in an opportunity set, we hold index funds. We hold things that we know aren't as good as some of the other stuff we have because we don't know when the markets will return to some level of sanity. We just know what will happen. And the beautiful thing about computers, I have to tell you though, is once the tide starts to swing the other way, they don't care. They'll buy whatever's working. And they'll accelerate the recovery of this portfolio as they accelerated the negative side. Second point, extraordinary options for patient capital. I said earlier, we've got a portfolio of really inexpensive businesses that are performing businesses. They're not in trouble. They will do great during a recession, for example, as businesses go. It's just literally almost, you keep thinking, so I can't believe this is what's really being offered to us. Third point, if you've been investing based on past performance and you just love, like many of us do, the things that have done well, be very careful what you own and what you paid for it. So one of the things I think is most ironic today about the supposedly low volatility index funds is that, yes, the businesses may be low volatility, but the valuations have gotten so extreme that the index, not the business, is going to be extremely volatile and extremely negatively biased when things start to unfold. And then these computers are going to make that even more ugly than ever people have ever seen before. So I feel badly for people who think they bought a safe investment. They've actually bought a very low return, high risk investment. But that's unfortunately what happens in markets. And lastly, if you ignore the noise, this is a little bit of reference to tweeting. Every day there's something new. Every day there's another geopolitical nightmare beginning or controversy starting. And so we just basically have taken the approach at this portfolio, which is like, we're not going to be able to figure any of that out for sure. But what we can do is when controversy emerges, when challenges emerge, pick through the rubble, find the great businesses that are trading at very good prices that actually have good business, and they're not even that well connected to the events that are causing concern. And that's how the foundation wins long-term, by a diversified set of exposure to things we can't understand, which is good businesses trading at very low prices. That's not hard to understand. Let me stop there and see if there are any questions that you might have.
Any questions to the participants?
Okay.
Okay. Just want to make sure technology is working. All right. Well, there we go. Well, thanks everybody for participating. We recorded this call to be on our website along with the slide deck. So if you know anybody who wants to listen to it or look at the slide deck, please feel free to share. Our next call will be in February and we'll be updating our calendar for that. And I hope you have a happy and joyous holiday season. Thank you so much.